Welcome to Anthony Plogue on Music. I'm Eddie Ludemer, the show's producer, here to introduce Season 4's first guest, Bill Williams. Bill has had an outstanding career as a symphony musician, chamber musician, and soloist. In addition to his performing, he's also a consultant with a wide range of clients, some including elite performers and institutions. In his coaching, he focuses on important tools that help musicians perform at their optimal level on a consistent basis. In the link section of this episode, there's a link to Bill's site, Optimal Performance, where he deals with things like stress and performance, more effective ways to practice, centering, and the power of mental rehearsal. Tony and Bill start their conversation with how Bill got involved in the area of performance psychology and how he combines his own performing with his coaching. Tony then asks Bill how he would coach him as a 19-year-old. They then get into a discussion about how fight or flight response affects performers, using riveting real-life examples of fight or flight involving a bear and a rattlesnake. They wrap up this portion of their discussion with Bill talking about ways of relaxing muscle tension and the concepts of centering and being grounded.
So, Bill Williams, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Tony. I'm really happy to be here and speaking with you today.
And I'm very happy to have you here. And there are a couple of areas that I'd like to talk about. You have such an interesting life and you've been involved in a number of different areas. So I'd like to talk about one of your main areas right now that I think could benefit a lot of people hearing this, and that is optimal performance. You have a website called Optimal Performance, and I'd like you to describe some of the services you have. You do performance seminars, lectures, keynotes, and individual coaching. Could you talk about first what you do, and then I have some questions for you?
Sure, absolutely, Tony. And I think as I get into talking about what it is I do in this space, I think it's important and interesting maybe to share why I became interested in this work. Understandably, as a trumpet player and someone who's played a lot of principal trumpet, but also chamber music and performed as a soloist, I was trying to sort out some of my own performance challenges that I had during, you know, my career, well, both during school and my career. And the question to me was, why was it that I could be absolutely prepared and prepared the same for a given number of evenings for a concert where there was, you know, quite a bit of stress on me, and I was feeling it a bit. One night things would go really well, and the next night things might not go quite as well. This was really a puzzling question for me, and over the years I had sought out a number of different ways to try to solve this, meditation, yoga, both of which I still practice on a regular basis, but they weren't really getting to the core of the issue. And ultimately, working with the sports psychologist Don Green, beginning with him about 25 years ago, it really opened up my world in terms of being able to perform consistently and to be able to communicate what I wanted to do on stage. And it had to do with managing my attention and also managing some of the physiological sort of phenomena that occur when we're under stress. It is dealing with excess muscle tension, learning how to focus my attention no matter how challenging the environment was. So fast forward a number of months working with Don as a client, and I found this work to be really, really helpful to me, and I began to integrate this, some of his teachings, the initial things I was learning, into my own teaching and coaching, and saw that this really helped a lot of my students and even some colleagues who are interested in learning about this to change their perspective on performing and help them to perform more consistently over time, and that these sort of like really excellent performances we have don't just have to be random events, but we can in fact control, you know, our performance to a high degree. At the same time, I want to be clear that this is not about playing perfectly. This is not about playing 110% of our very best playing. I put that best in quotes, but realistically, being able to play consistently at 90% or better than what we would think of as our best playing, but on a, you know, daily, nightly basis. So the work that I began doing in my own practice really started toward the end of my graduate studies in psychology, I always thought when I was a kid, I would have this sort of direct line career. You know, I'd study music, I'd win some auditions, play in symphony orchestras, and life would be that would be sort of my straight line trajectory. And of course, as I think like all of us find out over the span of our lives, these sort of direct line ideas we have and that things are going to be in this sort of perfect sequence of events doesn't necessarily happen, certainly not for most of us. And it's in fact these sort of shifts in opportunities and sort of setbacks that actually are new doors through which we can do some new things and learn about new ideas become really interesting. And that becomes the interesting, really compelling part of, you know, my career and life story, at least to me. So at this point in time, looking over the past number of decades, I've been able to combine my passion for and love of performing with a pretty robust and interesting set of other experiences, including coaching, teaching, working with different institutions on new initiatives. And within the scope of performance coaching, I do quite a lot of work with individual musicians. The individual musicians I work with, a lot of this work is, we work in a very sort of private manner, if that's something that the client is interested in doing. And we work on individual sessions, either physically in the same place or online, as became really the case during the pandemic. And I also am involved in any number of kinds of residencies. I've worked with many younger musicians and professional musicians and aspiring professional musicians at leading schools of music and conservatories, and bringing to their attention the opportunities they have to develop their performance skills through managing some very specific things that maybe are and aren't working for them as performers.
So it's interesting what you were talking about. I don't know if you know the Steve Jobs commencement address. I think it was 2005 at Stanford University.
Yes, to Stanford. Yes.
Yeah, where he said you can only connect the dots after the fact. And that sounds in a way like what you were talking about. One thing that I heard years ago from Bill Sullivan, who was first trumpet in the Utah Symphony, and he was good friends with the first trombone player in Utah. Ned was his first name. I forget his last name. Mm-hmm. Who ended up playing second trombone in San Francisco, I believe.
And he was Ned Meredith.
Yes. And he was also a mathematician. And
no kidding.
And he quit the San Francisco Symphony just to be a mathematician, just to teach mathematics, because he said, like you're talking about, one day things would go well, the next day things would not go so well, even though he was doing everything exactly the same. But he said, as a mathematician, every day he knew that 2 + 2 would be 4, and he wanted that certainty. So that's sort of interesting what you're talking about with that. I was wondering if we could try something that might be fun. We'll see. I'll put my neck on the chopping block here. So when I was 19 or 20, like you, all I wanted to do was be first trumpet in a symphony orchestra. I was practicing during the summer, 6 hours a day. I'd almost memorize my etudes, transposition etudes, et cetera, going into lessons. In rehearsals with my brass playing friends in Los Angeles, we were extremely immature and we goofed around a lot. But then sitting on stage for a concert, warming up, just before the conductor came on stage, I would be thinking, why am I doing this to myself? Because I would be so nervous. And so imagine that I am now 19 or 20, and I get in touch with you, and I want some help with my mental approach to music so that I can play concerts and feel comfortable. How would you start out? What are the steps you would take me through? And if I was an average student, how many sessions do you think it would take to get me to a place where I would pretty much on a consistent basis feel comfortable on stage? And of course, I would have times when I'd feel fine on stage, but then there'd be other times when I didn't.
Right. Well, let's unpack that, because that's a really, really compelling question. And of course, that's something that I reflect on a lot. So one thing to keep in mind is that this, if we want to call it nerves or stage fright or just inability to play at the level we know we can play, that we play when we're in the practice room. It can be a situational kind of experience. For example, if you're comfortable playing in a big symphony orchestra or in a concert band or in a brass quintet, maybe you're playing in a section or maybe you're playing first. That maybe, let's say, as our hypothetical situation, that might be something that doesn't make you that nervous because you're used to that. But in the case that you're talking about with the chamber music setting, this sort of goofing around in rehearsal and having a lot of fun in rehearsal, we move out of this warm cocoon of the practice room, and then suddenly you're on stage where you have to deliver. And if that's something that's creating a lot of anxiety, it probably has to do, first of all, with the kind of preparation you're having before you go on stage. But an even more fundamental set of questions we would look at is, the kind of preparation you have before you go on stage. We'd also look at what's going on with your attention. What happens to you before you begin to play? Do you just start to play? Do you have a very clear idea of how you're going to sound and how things are going to feel and resonate before you begin to play? Do you have, within the group, do you have a kind of, if you will, like a set of habits that gets you ready to go into this performance mode? Or do you just like go out on stage and wing it and hope for the best? When we're nervous, when our ability to perform breaks down under stress, there are three key areas that we'll examine within our setting. We have physiological manifestations of stress. So that could be muscle tension. You know, in a lot of what we experience, our heart might feel like it's racing. Or maybe our breathing gets shallower, which is an example of muscle tension down in this more diaphragmatic region. Another physiological manifestation of stress might be something that you're not even aware of, where your eyes are darting all over the place. And so we'll talk through that. I'll have clients oftentimes fill out a form to describe the symptoms they're feeling in this kind of performance situation, or we'll just discuss it in our session. And then we'll also analyze the mental aspects of stress, like what's going on? What are you thinking about? Are you thinking about what's happening in the audience? Does your mind tend to go to a note that you just cracked or something you're worried about? That is your mind jumping back and forth in present time, from present time to the future or the past? And we'll also look at some of the more emotional elements of stress. So we have physiological, mental, and emotional sort of manifestations of stress. And we'll look at that through the lens of the specific kind of performance that maybe you're wanting to improve upon. And from that gives us a place to begin to talk and to look at some specific exercises I can share with the client and that the client can work on, and then we can work on that together over time. Now, the beauty of the work that I do is that this isn't like a psychoanalytic process where we're unpacking everything from day one and continuing to work through this for the rest of one's life, per se, although this work, the benefits of this and these sort of tools that I share, I still use them on a daily basis. But within, I would say, realistically, three sessions or so, this could be 3 45 to 50 minute sessions, somebody with whom I'm working and they're devoted to this kind of, figuring these things out, they can see some really positive early results. And the cool thing about this work is that, remember, when our feelings and our thoughts are constantly changing, and when we have some success in something or you see something positive happening, like being able to kind of solve the puzzle of what was not working at the beginning of that concert or during that concert, it starts to build confidence, and then we can continue to build on that confidence. And over a brief amount of time, they can really start to change mindset as you employ some of these new habits and tools.
You have on your website a stress primer worksheet. And I wanted to ask you, I wanted to compare the two of us actually in terms of what you call the fight. Well, not you. It's a standard principle, the fight or flight response.
Right.
And with you, it was the fight response. With me, it was the flight response. In your case, maybe you could describe this encounter you had with a bear maybe about 20 years ago or so.
Oh, yeah. This is, I guess if there was a field study for acute stress, which is what we're really talking about, it couldn't have been I wouldn't use the word ideal, but like ideal or perfect example of this. So I want to keep everyone hanging a little bit. We'll talk about the bear attack in a moment, but I want to get to the fight or flight response. The fight or flight response is something that we're naturally hardwired to react in a way. So if there's something that's perceived as life-threatening, that our bodies will respond in a certain way to help to mobilize the body, whether it's the mind, the body, to either fight against the threatening situation or entity, or run away from it, okay? So in fight, the problem with this fight-flight response is that while on one hand, it's evolutionarily absolutely essential. It's helped us, you know, as humans to cope with extreme threat and, you know, life-threatening situations. The same fight-flight responses that are generated within the scope of a bear attack are the same kinds of things that we sense and feel and notice when we're on stage if we're feeling particularly under pressure. The mind triggers these responses without any conscious awareness or conscious processing. That's part of, on one hand, the success of this fight-flight response. On the other hand, that's one of the challenges we face when this response kicks in a contemporary setting where our mind and body haven't evolved enough to make this delineation between, yes, extreme threat, your life is under, you know, you're at risk of losing your life. Same set of feelings that you might have if you're walking on stage to play a solo at Carnegie Hall, if you haven't really sorted things out. Now, Tony, I want to get back to the bear attack, and I fear I may have spoiled something, or I don't know exactly what, but why don't you help guide me back into this?
Okay. You're on your mountain bike.
Oh, that,
and you have
yes.
an unpleasant surprise.
Okay. So I'm an avid mountain biker. I also played principal trumpet at the Santa Fe Opera in Santa Fe, New Mexico for close to a decade. I would always bring my mountain bike with me when I'd spend 10 weeks or so in the wilds of northern New Mexico. And on one of my free days from the opera later in the season, I went with some with my wife and a good friend visiting us from Switzerland up to a cabin near Taos, New Mexico. They went on a hike on one side of a canyon up into the mountains, and I went another way on one of my favorite mountain biking trails along a creek. And out of the corner of my eye, I was about a half a mile into what was supposed to be a really long day of mountain biking, I saw what I thought was a dog. And I looked to my left, and coming out of this creek, it was actually a black bear. I found out later it was a 300-pound male black bear.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Are you sure it was a black bear? Because black bears, I've heard that brown bears and grizzly bears are dangerous, but black bears, which I've encountered in the Sierras, only want food.
Well, this is a really interesting point you make, Tony. And there aren't, to my knowledge, grizzly or brown bears in northern New Mexico. And I actually found this out from the Fish and Game warden who had to track the bear after this very sad encounter. So it was, in fact, a black bear. And yes, black bears basically want nothing more than to get away or to get food. But this happened to be a summer or a year where there was a really late frost in the spring, which meant there was a lot of sort of plants and trees that would produce food for bears in the latter part of the summer weren't producing because there was a very late frost, and it sounded to me as if it had killed off a lot of their food supply or reduced it significantly. At the same time, it was a very wet summer, and that meant towns and adjacent to the mountains or in the mountains, and you know, there are a lot of apricot trees and fruit trees of all sorts in northern New Mexico. They were just filled with fruit. So this particular bear apparently had, I found this story out, of course, later, and this bear had broken into someone's house outside Taos, New Mexico. The homeowner was at home that morning, and it was looking for food because it was really, really hungry. And there were a number of these incidents that specific summer. This was 2001. And the homeowner was somewhere else in the house and decided to go against all guidance in a panic and took a gun, a rifle, and shot at this bear that was in his kitchen, I think. And the shooting at the bear, even at close range with a rifle, just made the bear enraged. It harmed the bear on some, you know, to some degree, and set it into a panic. And it fled his house and took off. And then I think after this fellow shot at the bear, and I can imagine he hit it or grazed it several times, he then called the fish and game wardens, and they set tracking dogs after the bear. And it was this unfortunate bear was tracked for a couple of hours through the mountains, and I happened to be intersecting the path of this bear just after it had been cornered by tracking dogs and then subsequently had mauled those tracking dogs. So wow. It was in a panic and in a rage, and I had no idea what was going on. And so this bear came after me, and I had to use I jumped off my mountain bike. Fortunately, I saw how I'd seen in the past how fast bears are. When you hear that bears can outrun like a racehorse for short periods of time on flat ground, that it's true. I saw a bear charge a friend's dogs a couple of summers prior to that. I mean, there are a lot of black bears in a lot of bears and wildlife, of course, in New Mexico, and in a remote part of New Mexico, on the side of a trail where we were, my friend's dogs flushed out a bear cub and wanted to play with it or antagonize it, and the mother bear came out of nowhere, and she charged the dogs back to within about 10 or 15 feet of where we were standing toward us, and it was like a flash of speed. So, yeah, I jumped off my bike and had to use my bicycle to defend myself against the bear. There are a lot of thoughts. Yeah, I remember looking down at it. It came at me four times, and I was in, you know, full adrenaline mode. Everything activated in, if you will, you know, we talked about physiological manifestations of stress and mental manifestations of stress and emotional manifestations of stress. So my eyes were darting all over the place. My mind was racing, trying to figure out how to deal with this bear as I saw its really big claws on the ground trying to get through the bicycle at me. It raised up and tried to push on the bike and almost knocked me backwards. And I, you know, started screaming and bellowing. My heart was racing. I was really, really tense. And at one point, the bear gave up, I guess, and moved off into high brush. And at that point, I was looking around trying to figure out where this bear had gone to exactly, because it moved into some high brush in front of me. But I remember having a watch on. One of the things that I've noticed is that if I'm really stressed out, I tend to lose track of time, you know, and time either tends to speed up or could slow down also. And so I used my watch to monitor how long I was going to stay in place, like a minute and a half or so, or 2 minutes before I decided to make my move to try to slowly back away from this bear. So, a lot of other interesting this sounds very strange on some level, but I took notes after this experience because I know that memory is faulty. At this very time, I was in beginning a graduate program in psychology in New York City at the New School for Social Research. I was just about to enter the program, and I'd been doing a lot of preparatory reading. One of the courses I took in the fall had to do with memory. And so I remember taking notes on this because I was aware that, you know, we tend to recall certain salient or noticeable things, but then memory over time changes to suit our own kind of personal narrative, if you will.
Well, I had a situation that happened, I'm guessing like maybe 4 months ago, that was the flight response. And so just the opposite of yours, which was my son just about maybe 2 weeks ago, week and a half to 2 weeks ago, completed the entire Pacific Crest Trail, which is Canada to Mexico. Mexico to Canada.
He completed the entirety of that.
Yeah,
that is
a little bit over 6 months.
That's amazing,
yeah,
Tony.
Yeah,
wow.
It was pretty great. This year, like a lot of people, he flipped like a couple of places. He skipped the Sierras at the beginning because it was dangerous because of snow, and then got the Sierras at the end of his trip. But I did the first 425 miles in the desert with him, the Mexico border to close to the Sierras. And I actually ended up I was hoping to do the first, I think it was 650 miles with him, but I had a problem with my foot, so I had to come out after 425 miles. But it was on the 11th day, and I was carrying a pack of about 35 pounds, and even though it was in the desert, there was an awful lot of mountain hiking, and not really high altitudes. And I was hiking up a mountain trail, and I had, before I left on this trip with my son, I had studied rattlesnakes, you know, and of course other, you know, possible problems. And one thing that they had said was it used to be that you would make two cuts above the rattlesnake bite if you got bit and suck the blood out. And they say, don't do that anymore because you're sucking toxins and basically the only thing they could say that would help is get to a hospital on time. So if you're about 2 or 3 days away from a city, you know, basically kiss it goodbye, essentially. So I realized afterwards that when I walked, when my right pole would go down, my left foot would go forward. And so I was hiking up this trail, and I looked up to see where the trail was going. My right pole went down, and I heard right there a rattle, like a buzzing.
Huh?
And I knew what that sound was. And as my left foot hit the ground, I pushed back and fell backwards. And I was lucky because I didn't fall off the trail and down the mountainside. And then pushed back with my feet. And the rattlesnake coiled, but just stayed there. It didn't come after me. And after a couple of minutes, then went off the trail. And it happened so fast. It took me later. I had to sort of, again, thinking of memory, figure out exactly what happened. But that was very much a flight response. Again, adrenaline really going fast. The difference between, I think, your fight response and my flight response and a concert is that ours happened in the moment, extreme, I guess, adrenaline rush in the moment to protect us one way or the other.
Sure.
But in a concert, you're sitting on stage, or some of the times a week before, you're in your room worrying about a concert. And so it's sort of like a slow buildup rather than a spontaneous release of adrenaline.
Well, you know, this is, as you're talking about this, this stress response, the acute stress response, if we want to talk about this fight-flight response, kicks in the face of novel, unexpected, threatening situations. So we're talking about life-threatening stuff here. You and I are at this point in time. But interestingly, ego threat, that is fear of loss of reputation, fear of, and then other kinds of threat, fear of loss of opportunity, can trigger the same intensity of response, it's said, as an actual life-threatening situation. Now, as you're sharing this with us, your experience. I remember reading about this, by the way, Tony, in one of your posts.
Yeah, I posted some videos on
Facebook.
I
was quietly following this and looking forward to talking to you about it. I think this actually sets up an interesting sort of opportunity for listeners. So you talked about, you know, this sort of flood of adrenaline. We were discussing, you know, time for me. It was a longer experience than this shock of almost being attacked by the rattlesnake. That is the bear confrontation I had. But there are a number of things we notice, you know, maybe that went on, that, you know, we noticed physiologically. I mean, mentally and emotionally. And I would encourage people, if they're, you know, as they're thinking about preparing for an event or an event that makes them uncomfortable, to really notice, you know, imagine they're in the event and notice how they are affected physically, you know, where muscle tension is in their bodies, for example. You know, for a brass player, it might be in the diaphragmatic region or the shoulders or the embouchure. And jumping to one very simple thing that we maybe will revisit later, but muscle tension is one of the real challenges we have to being able to perform well, right? We tend to get in our own way as the body tries to overmanage things. So if you notice an area or areas of muscle tension, something really simple to do is to breathe in, tense up that muscle, that set of muscles or those muscle groups on the in-breath, and then exhale and drop the tension out. This very simple isometric exercise will help you to release a slight bit of tension, and your body just physiologically will be slightly more relaxed than it was before you breathed in, tensed up that muscle or those muscles, and then released it, and then released the tension on the out-breath. This isn't to say that you want to be relaxed like an overcooked piece of spaghetti relaxed, because we won't ever get to that place, but it's really about just dealing with this excess bit of tension that kind of feeds into our whole system, you know, the mind-body system. And by releasing a little bit of that, we often will, it'll help us to be a little more grounded and get out of our way when we're performing. So back to your experience with you know, your confrontation with the rattlesnake, what do you remember noticing about, you know, sensations or thoughts or what that was like, Tony? Because that sounds like it was really a quick flash of something. You know, what were your reflections on your experience, you know, within that kind of framework we're talking about, physical or mental, emotional?
That was something that I had worried about actually on this hike, because I had studied it some, and I knew that, I think I'd read that there were either 5 or 7 different types of rattlesnakes in that Southern California portion. And earlier that day, I had seen my first rattlesnake, which was actually laying right across the trail, almost looking like a log. And later on, my son and I saw one, too. He almost stepped on one. And so I think my reaction was just, when it happened, you know, I pushed back and I fell back and I pushed my feet back so I would get away from the snake. And my first thought was, have I been bitten? And I realized that I didn't think I had. And I think what happened was that the snake was asleep or sunning himself or herself on the trail facing forward. If it was facing down the trail, I think I probably would have been bitten. And so I think my thought was just to get away from the snake, to be as far away from the snake as I could. But when I'd fallen backwards because my pack was heavy and pulled me over. And when I stood up, I forget if my pack was still on or not. So I forgot that memory. But when I stood up, the snake was just there. So I don't know why I did it, but I took out my phone and I took a video of the snake, you know, to document what I had been through. I don't think you did that with a bear. And then a couple of minutes later,
no.
When the snake was going across the trail very slowly to another place, which is then after that I left. I could go up the trail. I took a video of that as well. And those are the two things that I posted on Facebook. So I'm not sure exactly what I thought outside of it. It happened so fast, and I got away from the snake. And then I think my pack was off so that in case the snake was going to come for me, I was going to run back down the trail. But he didn't.
Yeah. So it's, well, in your case, this flight response was very, we would say, like, very adaptive. I mean, that worked. It worked. But when you're walking on stage, you know, to play the second Brandenburg, and your heart's racing and you're a bit panicked and your eyes are darting all over the place, not necessarily the best sort of place to be. And so, right? And so this is the kind of thing that we're definitely analyzing, so that you can, you start to, one starts to recognize very specific things that happen. And there are tools that you can use to address these before you go on stage, whether it's in the practice room or in the wings before you walk on stage, and then even while you're on stage, to, you know, mitigate this sort of, you know, automatic set of responses that sometimes seems to take over. You know, I know I had my own share of concerts where I remember playing, things didn't necessarily go so well, and I walked off stage feeling like, what was that? Or, you know, I almost felt like I wasn't there, you know, on some level.
You know, speaking of the Brandenburg, my favorite bad review that I ever got, I could always play the Bach B minor Mass basically without a problem, but the Brandenburg was always tough for me. And I got a review from the LA Times that said, Anthony Plogue gave a courageous performance. And I thought that was the nicest way of
that was
putting
generous.
That somebody really went in the toilet, you know? So, well,
that was very generous.
That was
yes.
very, 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 very kind. And he was true. It was courageous, and actually it was not very good. So let me ask you about a couple of principles that you focus on. One is centering,
yeah.
and the other is attentional focus. I think you've talked about attentional focus
sure.
a little bit, but maybe talk mm-hmm. about centering.
Yeah, let's talk about centering a bit. The centering technique is a technique that was, first of all, I want to make sure I'm giving credit where credit is due. Robert Nideffer, who is a sports psychologist who did a lot, he was the coach of swimmers, and he was working both with athletes, but was a psychologist, was interested in understanding the components of attention and also what is happening in this moment when things seem to be going awry. And Don Green, the sports psychologist Don Green, worked with Nideffer many years ago. And so the centering technique is really a tool. It's got seven sort of parts to it to harness the body and mind to prepare it for the task at hand. And so on one part of the centering technique, and I'll talk about it briefly after I sort of unpack, as I am right now, the sort of the ideas behind the principles behind it. It's about helping the body to ground itself. It's giving the eyes a place to rest. That is a place for the eyes to rest, so they're not moving all over the place. Unbeknownst to us, oftentimes we don't quite know what to do with our eyes, and people tend to look around a lot. And as we are when we are distracted, and we're feeling a bit stressed out or under a bit of threat or whatever you want to call it, the eyes darting around, it's like the body's trying to find a place to run to, or to understand, you know, what this threat is and try to deal with it. It gives the eyes a place to rest. It also gives us a place to send our sound and energy out, this area where the eyes rest in front of us. And then we're working through a grounding exercise, allowing the body, whether it's seated or standing, to feel more contact with the floor. If you've ever noticed at a recital or a place where somebody isn't feeling particularly comfortable, you'll notice them kind of moving around a lot or moving from foot to foot. And I know that a feeling I used to have when I was performing standing up is I'd feel almost like I'm being pulled upwards off the ground, and my knees would get kind of locked. Those are all classic symptoms of muscle tension. But the feeling you want to have really in this centering process, in the technique, is that your body has a lot of weight in it and it's connected to the floor. Whether you're standing or seated in a chair, the idea being that when you're grounded and you have a really solid and heavy kind of base from which to work, everything in the upper body tends to be a bit more free. And some very simple adjustments we might do in the scope of a session or a couple of sessions will make a huge difference in terms of like sound production, irrespective of the instrument. So we've got the physiological things, the physiological manifestations of stress, dealing with that, dealing with some of the knowing where to put your energy and where to direct your sound as you're playing and sending it out rather than holding back, which is something we tend to do when we play softly. And then as you ground yourself, you start to calm your mind down. It's kind of like, and as you calm the mind down through the multiple steps of the centering process, at the very end, we turn the volume up metaphorically on that which it is you do when you're playing really well. So at the end of the centering technique, we have a cue, a process cue. It could be the sound of what you're about to do. When the mental image or sound in your ear is really clear, that the body tends to follow. So we're quieting the body, calming the mind, giving the sound a place to go at the end of the exercise, and then right before you play, reminding yourself of how you want and will sound. If this makes sense, Tony, feel free to jump in or ask afterwards. The idea is that so much of the time, I'd say many players, I mean players when they're under stress, and particularly younger players, will play and then they react to what comes out of the instrument rather than having a real clarity of mind of what it's going to sound and feel like before you pick the instrument up or before you play a note. And so instead of this kind of reactive approach to playing, centering also allows us to be more generative, if that makes sense, mm-hmm. in developing mental clarity. And so the cool thing is when you're this grounded and you're focused on what you're going to sound and feel like, it really helps us from overthinking things because we're really good at doing one thing at a time mentally. You know, it's when we try to stack and multitask that things become challenging. And when we flood our conscious awareness with sound and feeling of what we're about to do, it could be the first few beats of a piece of music you're about to play, and making it really clear, it crowds out, interestingly, a lot of the other distractions around us. You know,
that's interesting because if you think of really, really great players, this seems to be a common practice amongst them, that when they do make a mistake, immediately after the mistake, they are playing great again. And I think some less accomplished players, they make a mistake and that bothers them, and then it's sort of a downhill slide. And I think maybe that, even if they're not involved with practicing centering, they are centered.
Yes, yeah. And, you know, the thing is, this work isn't for 100% of people out there. There are a number of people, obviously many great performers have their own way of getting to this place. But I would say the vast majority of people, you know, benefit tremendously from having this, because this is like a kind of like a set of tools that you can develop over time. I see this as or more important almost than like fundamental trumpet technique, certainly for me. Some of these tools, and I really agree with you. This kind of sort of mental strength isn't really the right word, but clarity of mind that a great performer brings to the table. You know, early on in our conversation, I was talking about this is not about perfect, right? This is about 90% plus of your, in quotes, best playing, but doing it consistently. And when we make a mistake, the great performers are able to continue. It doesn't send them off the rails. Mistakes happen. I mean, that's And I think, you know, certainly that's something that's easy to forget about, in whether it's in a solo setting or, you know, even more so in this like kind of audition setting where people feel like, oh, you know, I didn't, you know, I just have to play everything in I use air quotes again, perfectly in order to do well in an audition, when that's absolutely not the case.
Tony and Bill continue their discussion on the subject of auditions and going over Bill's 8-week program that details his take on audition prep. They discuss cultural differences in dealing with performance challenges and the process of learning from different perspectives. In addition to his work with Optimal Performance, Bill was also the dean of the New World Symphony for 3 years, so he discusses some of the innovations coming out of New World, including the YouTube Symphony. They end their conversation with Bill talking about his career as a trumpet player and what it was like to record the Mahler symphonies with the San Francisco Symphony as principal trumpet. To hear this portion of Tony and Bill's conversation, please consider becoming a contributing listener by clicking on the big blue button on the podcast website, or by going directly to anthonyplogue.com/on-music.supercast.com. As a listening contributor, you'll be able to listen in to additional audio content and study up on Tony's podcast Reflections, where he does a recap of his interviews, focusing on suggestions for students. You'll also have access to our Discord server, where you can join an ongoing discussion while meeting and sharing ideas with other listeners. Thank you for listening in, and be sure to help us spread the word.